The Bill Myers Show podcast is sponsored by Clouser Drilling. They've been leading the way in Southern Oregon well drilling for over 50 years. Find out more about them at clouserdrilling.com.
That's 770-KMED.
Hey, I appreciate you being here. 3 minutes after 7. Steve, you wanted to talk a bit about that talk with Dr. Lieberman. And she was from Bellevue.
And
yes. Tell me your thought about that, huh?
When I got drafted, I ended up in Korea, and I was trained as a surgical technician, and there was nothing much going on. And anyway, Dr. Michael Stittleman was a doctor who had been put into the surgical unit, and he was a psychiatrist. And the Army, of course, said, well, you're a doctor, so we're going to put you into this hole because we need a doctor. And anyway, I got to know him pretty well. I was working in a dispensary at night, and he was on duty, and so we would play checkers or Scrabble.
Yeah,
or something.
What did you take away from that experience, though? What was a unique insight you wanted to bring to that?
Well, it ended up he got tagged by the Army, the 8th Army, to solve a bunch of problems. They were having trouble with people getting in trouble, basically. They were getting Article 15s and just not doing the job that they were supposed to do, and they had so many of them, they wanted him to fix it. So he trained 6 of us to interview people, and he gave us categories. So if we interviewed somebody who'd been in trouble, we could send on information back to him as to what we thought was going on.
All right, so you ended up helping soldiers perform better. But there was no shortcut, though, right? I guess that's kind of what Dr. Lieberman was sort of mentioning, that there's no shortcuts on dealing with this, right?
Dr. Stittleman got into Bellevue Hospital was he was doing his residency, and the police were putting people, or the judicial system was putting people in the mental hospital because they didn't know what to do with them. And so the hospital was full, and the administration at that time said, hey, we've got to figure out what to do. So Dr. Stittleman worked in this program to try to help people who were in trouble to get them out of the hospital. And in his residency, they would interview people and then determine a plan and then work through a plan based on what was going on in that particular person's life. Sometimes it's just to train people how to be people who didn't get raised properly.
That's a really interesting statement there. Yeah. Thanks for sharing a bit of that, though. Yeah, it wasn't just give a pill, though, from the sounds of it. Let me talk with John. John's in Ashland. Hello, John. Good to have you on. What were you thinking about this particular topic?
Go ahead. In 1970, I did my internship at the U of O Medical School Psychiatric Crisis Unit, and it was part of the medical school. And regular doctors, their whole psychiatric training, they could either spend 2 weeks in our facility or 2 weeks in a longer-term facility. That's the only psychiatry they got. And the second thing I wanted to say is that now, like if you're a psychiatrist, an MD versus a PhD, and you go to work at a mental health clinic like in Jackson County, your contract says you have to see 4 people an hour. That gives you 15 minutes to interview them, diagnose them, and give them a pill.
That is absolutely no time. John, that's absolutely no time to be able to.
You're not allowed to do therapy. Absolutely, it's written into the contract, according to many friends of mine that are MD psychiatrists, that you have to see 4 people an hour, and you have to just give them medication. Now, they were starting that at the medical school even when I was there. Of the 14 or so people in residency, only 4 of them actually wanted to learn how to do therapy, and the rest were there just to, if you have this kind of, if you're paranoid schizophrenic, you get Thorazine or Haldol. If you're this, you get that.
Yeah.
If you're manic depressive, and it's very mechanistic. There's no humanity in psychiatry. So pharmaceuticals have taken over psychiatry. The only psychiatrists that you can get help with are those that refuse to take any kind of insurance. And then they can have 45 minutes with you, and they charge you $500.
But they're probably more effective in the long run.
Oh, much more. I mean, it's the only way you can change anybody on a deep level. The pills just alter behavior for a while. And, of course, it changes. And I've seen people kill themselves after many times when I worked there, when they would give people anti-depression medicine, they'd jump off a bridge or kill themselves. It's very tricky.
I really appreciate the story there. Thanks for kind of confirming what Dr. Lieberman was mentioning, too, with your experience. Take care, John. It's 8 minutes after 7. All right, we're going to break here briefly for the Hannity update coming up. And then I'm really looking forward to talking with Constant Vaughn. Constant Vaughn was working in the airline industry back when it was really something, back when it wasn't the Greyhound bus in the sky, so to speak. And she's written a memoir of her experiences in the airline world from the 1960s, kind of like the golden age of flying. And what has changed between then and now? I'm wondering if she's flown recently, but I'm looking forward to chatting with her in a couple here.
Not sure what to buy your loved one for Christmas? Can't find what you're looking for? A gift card from Oregon Truck and Auto Authority is the perfect choice.
Let's talk 106.3 KMED.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on Southern Oregon's home for conservative talk. Mornings on KMED at 99.3 KBXG. Call Bill at 770-5633. That's 770-KMED. Here's Bill Meyer.
13 minutes after 7, Constance Vaughn joins me right now. Constance Vaughn is the author of a fascinating book. It's called A Dream Takes Flight. A Dream Takes Flight. And it has to do with what it was like, Constance, I guess, to fly before it became a Greyhound bus in the sky, and as I term it, with chickens in the overhead compartment. Would that be fair? Would that be fair, kind of where sometimes, when's the last time you've flown? I have to ask.
I fly a lot. Probably this year sometime I flew. I have good friends in Georgia and Ohio, and I fly there quite a bit.
Yeah. Now, you live in Jupiter, Florida, is where you do. And this is not your story. You're telling the story of Susie Q, though, right, in this book, A Dream Takes Flight?
Exactly. This is her life story, 41 and three-quarter years in the air, A Dream Takes Flight. It's a lighthearted, behind-the-scenes, fun, inspiring, make-you-laugh, make-you-cry kind of story.
Okay. So what does Susie Q, does Susie Q still fly today? I'd be curious to hear her overall impression of the not-so-friendly skies these days.
Well, she, you know, it was a very glamorous time back in the 60s when she started. She was a young girl. And it was how she saw flying at that time was it was the most glamorous way to live your life and see the world. And I always teased her and I said, so you had to serve a few drinks to see the world. Big deal. And that's what she always says. So Susie had a very optimistic outlook on flying and travel. And she was just inspired by a stewardess that she saw step off of an airplane with long white gloves and a pillbox hat. And it hit her, and she said, this is what I am doing with my life.
That was not unusual. I mean, there were a lot of people who looked at the world of flying at that time, especially in those days, late 50s, early 60s and beyond. And it was incredibly, incredibly glamorous and kind of a rarefied air because it was really expensive. I mean, it's always been expensive to fly, but it was really expensive in those days, wasn't it?
Oh my gosh, exactly. That you nailed it. It was an elite situation. You dressed up, you put on your best heels, your best dress. As a little girl, I traveled quite a bit and I had my Mary Jane shiny and my dress and we would get on. And I always looked forward to the meals they served us. It was always a full course meal and then dessert. And I got my wings when I got on the airplane. And it was extremely glamorous and extremely, I guess you could say, rare. The airplanes were not full at that time. I remember flying at times when, you know, we might be the only ones on the airplane. And nowadays, you know, it's like riding a bus or herding cattle and you get peanuts, literally.
Yeah. And of course, you know, it's kind of, and I hate to put it this way because, you know, I've dressed this way sometimes too, but we've decided that it's okay to put on your pajama bottoms and your T-shirt and with slippers and you get on a plane these days.
It's such a radical difference, isn't it, compared to what it was? Exactly. I mean, it's sweats and hoodies and tennis shoes. And I see people on the plane quite a bit with pajamas, for sure.
Yeah, indeed. So, Constance, tell us about Susie Q, how she got into it. Can we say which airline? Well, I guess it doesn't matter which airline she was with because Susie Q's retired. She's not working there anymore. Where did she start? Which airline did she start off in?
It was United Airlines. And the inspiring story and how it hit her, I put it in the book. It's kind of in the opening. Her father had her pick him up at the airport, and she was around 16 at the time, still in high school. And she was a rebel on her own before this even hit her. And she went to pick up her dad, and a stewardess and pilot stepped out of the airplane and down the stairs to the tarmac. And she was wearing a pillbox hat, long white gloves.
Yep.
And she just sparkled in the sun. And Susie said, "This is it. This is what I am doing," much to the chagrin of her parents. You know, they had bigger plans for her. She had quite a country club life. She lived a very beautiful life in West Virginia. And when she saw this, she said, "I'm not going to be in the kitchen and making babies. I'm going to see the world." Mm-hmm. So she rebelled quite a bit. When she got to stewardess school, it was a different story, though.
Oh, really? Now, because a lot of what this book is interesting about is the way women were treated in those days. And it was a very different culture. So what was it like when she actually got to a stewardess school? Just a little thumbnail sketch of that.
She called it prison. It was 6 weeks, and they do intensive training for emergency situations. So I have to put that there. I have to give her credit for that. But they spend 1 week on her appearance. You know, what's your perfect lipstick for you? No fillings, no piercings, no tattoos. And at the time, if you can imagine this, Bill, you could not be married. You could not have children. You could not have the hope of it. So the whole point was to capture women at their prime, dress them up, shine them up. And she even had girdle checks, if you can imagine what that would be like.
Okay, no, wait. To be a stewardess, you had to wear a girdle. You had to wear one. Or if you were wearing a girdle, they made you, or they fired you. I don't know. How did that work?
It was required. And there was a woman that did a girdle check. She would come between each flight and pull your girdle to see if you had it on. Yeah, it was required.
I can't even imagine anybody even doing something close to that right now. Can you?
No, I mean, it would be so egregious. People would say, you know, this is completely hurting my feelings. Like, you cannot check. First of all, I'm not wearing a girdle. So secondly, you're not going to grab my girdle and snap it on me. It was a very different time in the 60s.
Well, this was the era of, like that television show or the series Mad Men, right? You know, that kind of thing.
Oh, yes, very much so. So you can see how women were treated. Not that this is about how women are treated, but it does give you a little, you know, snapshot into the lives of what stewardesses. They were so, their working conditions were incredibly difficult. They were
like, so how? Like, how would that be difficult then? Because it's one thing you see the glamour, and what was it really like once you were out of stewardess school prison?
Exactly. That's the whole point. That's what the book is about. And so she goes into, you know, when you're flying and you travel in groups and you check into hotels, they really weren't that glamorous of hotels. It would always be the cheapest hotel that the airline could find. Not that that's horrible, but you're away from home 5 days a week. And so you lived in these hotels. You were bused to the hotel and then bused back to the airline. You know, some flights could be 12 hours, depending on when you went international. And it was pretty intense because you had to be sparkly shiny through that entire experience. And I mean, I fly on an airplane now and I feel haggard after I get off the plane. I'm like, oh my gosh. So I can only imagine what stewardesses felt like back then. But it wasn't as glamorous behind the scenes. That's kind of some of the stories that I tell. I actually tell all of her little secrets and stories of what the stewardesses are doing and what they do when they're making your drinks and all the good stuff.
You know, I have to ask something I've always wondered. You know, you always hear the rumors about was there a lot of fraternization? And I know this may sound a little, I don't want to be crass about this, but the Mile High Club, you know, you hear all this talk about this. Now, I've never been involved in anything like that because it's just not my kind of experience, I guess. But was it as wild as the swinging 60s are sometimes portrayed in television shows? And because I was only a little kid when this was all going on, apparently. I wouldn't have understood at the time.
I will say yes. I don't get into too much detail about that. I do give a couple glimpses of some experiences that Susie had in that regard. One of the things that really hit me when she was telling me the story, when she very first started, they handpicked her to do a men-only flight.
Okay.
Men only. No wives, no children. And they advertised it and marketed it as, you know, an evening out. And so hop on a plane and fly to California and have a drink or two. And they would handpick the stewardesses. And I don't go too much into the detail because I don't want to pry on Susie.
Yeah.
But, you know, there definitely were egregious conditions, I should say. However, what you're kind of asking is also with the pilots and the stewardesses, I mean, all I can say about that really is that they traveled together alone without their mate and checked into hotels and then checked out. So all kinds of things happened.
Yeah, and you spent a lot of time on the road away from people, yeah, away from your
Absolutely.
Family. So naturally, it's no different, I guess, than the movie stars doing that kind of thing. But I read an account one time of some of the battles, and I think this must have been in a blog post a number of years ago, in which a captain was said that they would have challenges that some of the stewardesses, I don't know if Susie ever did this, but they would do challenges to see how smooth of a landing that they could do. Right? And they would put up, and this is in the 1960s, it's probably no longer done, but they would put up all the lids on the toilet seats, right? And the goal was that you would dust the airline or the jet so smoothly down onto the runway that the lids would remain upright. I don't know if did she ever talk about anything like that, but I thought it was a great story when I read that.
That is a great story. Absolutely. There's stories like that for sure. More to do with stewardesses than pilots. I kind of don't delve into the pilots too much because I could only speak from her voice and I could only speak from her position. And I didn't want to give away too much. Like I said, I made it historic fiction.
Yeah.
I changed the names to protect the guilty. Actually.
The guilty. Constance Vaughn, and her book is A Dream Takes Flight, and it's about the life of Susie Q here, and she didn't let anything get in her way. So she's flying the world, and this was one of probably the few opportunities for young women back in those days to have that kind of a life, right? To escape, I guess, the home life. Would that be fair? You know, really? And that's why I think it was so popular with so many young women.
Oh my gosh, you nailed it exactly. Susie saw it as a way to travel the world when there was really not another option for a 19-year-old girl in the 60s, if you can imagine. Mm-hmm. So careers weren't an option for women. I found Susie to be very inspiring because she stepped out and lived her life the way she wanted to live it. And she didn't let her parents, you know, stop her. Her mother in the very beginning of the book says to her, "Oh, Susie, when are you going to get over this? I need grandchildren. Like, how long is this job thing going to last for you?" You know, it wasn't.
But, you know, that wasn't an uncommon statement from relatives back in those days if someone was a career girl in those days.
Absolutely. And nothing stopped Susie. And that's what was so inspiring for me when I heard her story. She went through many, many decades. If you can imagine 41 and three quarter years flying the friendly skies as opposed to being in the kitchen, Susie did it her way. That would definitely be her motto. She did it her way, and she did it with a smile and grace.
Did she ever get married with kids at all?
She actually was married three times. Third time is a charm, and mm-hmm. she did have two children. And I asked her about that because I was like, you can't be pregnant. You know, you can't weigh more than 125 pounds. And she said she was very fortunate. She didn't gain a lot of weight, and she, towards the end, would, you know, save up her time and take off and have her kids, and the airline was no much the wiser. So back then, you know, it was not a thing for women to really be a career person. They were supposed to be home, but the airline industry completely was the opposite of that.
When did it start changing? Because I have old magazines and old papers, and I love looking at the ads sometimes, and you'll see some of the airline advertisements when it comes to the stewardess of those days. It was so sexist. It's like stuff that you couldn't even believe. They were essentially hung out there like pieces of meat, you know, for the male business traveler, right? I mean, that's the bottom line. That's the way it was.
Absolutely. It would be an SNL skit today, for sure. It was, you know, believe it or not, it was in the 80s when things actually started to change. Luggage got wheels. So that was a big thing.
Uh-huh.
And also, you got points on your credit card to fly. So flying became a completely different experience. It was glamorous in the beginning, and it became more of a herding cattle situation. That started very much in the 80s. And one of the things I do in the book that's so much fun that people have commented is at the end of each chapter, I do it by decade, I put the rules and regulations and guidelines of the airline industry. And when you see how those rules and regulations that were in the 60s still held in the early 80s, that was shocking to me. But that was actually, I think, the pivotal point. It was in the 80s.
I didn't realize that hung on until so late. That surprises me. That is a surprise to me. Does Susie Q have any comment on the level of service today? And I've only had first class tickets once or twice. I think a couple of times when I was upgraded to first class. And I swear, first class today is probably worse than flying coach back in the 1960s and 70s, because I remember I spilled a drink, somebody bumped my drink and spilled the drink, and you end up having flight attendants more or less barking at me and then throwing me towels. Here, clean it up yourself, jerk. You know? That kind of, and I just can't imagine that was being done back in those eras. I can't imagine that at all.
Oh my gosh, exactly. And what an interesting point to what you're saying is that her father was really against it. And he said, Susie, you're nothing more than a glorified waitress, you know? And she said, that's not how I see it. But by the time that she went through 41 and three quarter years, she said, you know, you did just become a servant in the air. Even though stewardesses and stewardess, which are now called flight attendants, the BTC, they are highly trained professionals in the event of an emergency. Other than an emergency, they really are just serving you, you know, now peanuts and Coke. But back then, it was a much more prestigious situation. And like you said, first class, coach was like first class back then. First class was crazy. Coach was, you know, so beautiful and lovely. I remember flying on empty airplanes sometimes. So that was really fun. But nowadays, I haven't been on an empty airplane in 30 years.
Oh, no. Oh, no. And trying to get a better seat and doing a little flip or something, it's pretty much done. Most of the time, you always hear them say, we have a very full flight today. So, yeah, I know. It's always a very full flight today.
We know it's full. We can tell.
Yeah. Before we take off here, and I'll put your information up here, Constance. Thanks for having joined the show for a few minutes, by the way. But what is probably your biggest surprise in Susie's story, or that kind of surprised you, that you thought that one thing about airlines and then she brings something like, no, that's not the way it was at all?
That is a great question. I think that I didn't really appreciate what stewardesses literally had to go through to be a stewardess. The school alone was pretty egregious, and the majority of women fell out before they even ever flew the first airline. And then after that, if you can appreciate that they were away from their families and living in hotels, they would fly 8-12 hours, and they'd have to get up at 3 o'clock in the morning and get back on that plane and turn around and go home. And it just isn't as glamorous as it appeared. And they really were put through the ringer, and their wages were very nominal. They really weren't paid to the extent. In fact, the average income for a stewardess now is around $50,000. So you can imagine what it was back in the 60s.
So if the average income for a flight attendant now is 50 grand, it's not huge money in the grand scheme of things.
No, not at all. In fact, I think I asked her her first paycheck, and I'm trying to recall the number, but it was around $40. Was her first 2 weeks paycheck in the 60s.
$40. Man, you made me spit my coffee almost here. $40 even then. All right. Hey, well, thanks for bringing the story out here. I think that's just a lot of fun. A dream takes flight. A dream takes flight. It's Susie Q's story is the subtitle of it, by Constance Vaughn. And I'll get that out there. And what an interesting travel and life story. Thank you so much for having joined us this morning, Constance. Be well.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you for having me. I really enjoyed it. You do well.
Yeah, and this is available in all sorts of places, you know, the Amazons, the Barnes & Nobles, the local bookstore, wherever that might be. But do you have a main website, too? Could you give us that briefly?
Yes. It's an acronym for the publishing. It's Palm Beach Proper Publishing. So it's PBPUBPub.com.
Okay.
PBPUB.
Okay. I'll get that figured out, okay? And we'll find you, all right? Do take
Great.
Care. Thanks again.
Thank you, Bill. Bye-bye.
731 at KMED, 99.3 KBXG.
Rule number one, if you're looking to sell a home, choose a local real estate agent. Hey, it's Lars. And why? It starts with an overall knowledge of the area. But even more importantly, a local agent is a friend and neighbor who cares about the community just as much as you do. In the Medford area, that'd be my good friend Jared Hokanson of Hokanson Realty.
Merry Christmas and Happy New Year from all of us at Kelly's Automotive Service in Grants Pass in Medford, where we service your vehicle. But take care of you.
You're hearing the Bill Myers Show on 106.3 KMED.
Well, it's Christmas time, pretty baby, and the snow is falling.
of my favorite secular Christmas songs, Elvis. You know, every time I hear that Santa Claus is back in town, I just envision a 1959 Cadillac as a sleigh. I don't know. 1959 Cadillac with a rocket ship taillights, you know, back in the day. Besides, it sounds like the Jordanaires were having a good time. I'll bet they were pretty thoroughly lubricated, okay? Now then, I wanted to, by the way, complete this story. You know, we talked with Constance Vaughn just a moment ago about the stories of Susie Q, the stewardess back in the 1960s, started in the early 1960s with United Airlines. And I had mentioned that another post, another story I had read at one point, talked about the competitions that that stewardesses would set up with the pilots, like how smooth of a landing can you make? I wanted to tell that whole story here briefly. I thought it was pretty funny. I'm going to have to clean it up a little bit for broadcast. But the promise was, okay, how smoothly can you land this 747? That was the whole deal. And so the stewardesses went in and put up all the lids on the toilets and all the entire airline. Entire airline is what they did. And the wager was... Now, this is accordingly, you know, this is how the story went with Captain X. Captain X was the guy's name who told the story. The wager was that a certain sexual favor favored by a past president, we'll just kind of leave it at that, if you could land the 747 and have all of the toilet seats lids stay up, okay? And so this is really hard to do. Well, the thing is, the pilot ended up dusting the runway. All the lids stayed up until the very end when they pulled up to the gate. And we had the guy with the flashlight things or the cones or whatever he's waving in the heads, you know, waving in his hands, you know, to direct the pilot. And he just says, whoa, stop. And they hit the brakes, and then they could hear all of the lids fall down. All the lids of the toilets then fell down. So they dusted the runway, but weren't able to complete the deal, so to speak. It's 735 at KMED. 99.3 KBXG. This is the Bill Myers Show.
Everyone deserves a fast and reliable connection, one that helps better their everyday through the things they value most.
Or rehab, 421 homes. None of the money has been earmarked for Southern Oregon. Bill London, KMED.
Imagine that. None of the money coming down here. We'll be talking with Herman Bearchicker in just a moment, Josephine County Commissioner. We'll be talking about how we see things flowing over the next few weeks, maybe into 2025. Deplorable Patrick, hey, you wanted to weigh in on the Constance Vaughn interview, the great stories from the sky, huh? What are you saying, huh?
Well, I love airlines and flying stories, and this might be the best time for one that I wanted to tell you. And when I was 18, I got my pilot's license and aircraft mechanics license, and I never really took it all the way to airline flying. I'm not an airline pilot. I fly small planes like Cessnas, four seats.
Sure.
Anyway, I was on a Aeromexico flight one time, leaving out of L.A., flying down into Mexico. And when we got on the airplane, I sat in the row right up next to the front and in the aisle seat. And the Mexicans are more casual than a lot of people. And
I think that's a fair, assessment. Sure. Okay. How casual was it?
Okay. I'm going to tell you how casual it was. And, you know, I'm sitting there in the front. And the pilots never even closed the cockpit door. I'm sitting there. I'm looking at the pilots.
Uh-huh.
And I'm thinking, you know, these guys are really casual. And in like 5 minutes, we're going to be out of United States airspace. I waved the stewardess over, and I had my wallet out with my pilot's license and my mechanic's license. I said, could you take this up there and show those guys and ask them if I could sit in the jump seat?
Mm-hmm.
She took it up there, and she says, hey, come on up. So I went right up there and flew with the pilots. In the DC-9, the jump seat is right between the pilot and co-pilot, and got to fly the whole flight down there in the cockpit with those guys.
Wow, I mean, that is pretty casual. We now think it's pretty routine to shut, and these days in the United States at least, lock them, right? You got, you know, they're seriously locked. About what era was this? When did this happen?
Probably in the 80s.
Yeah.
Mid-80s.
And as Constance was mentioning, that's when things started changing a bit in the airline world in the 1980s. Thanks for the story, though. Appreciate that, Patrick. Well Burns Weapons is your friendly gun.
Hi, I'm Lisa with Pacific Survey Supply, and I'm on KMED.
17 before 8. Herman! Josephine County Commissioner Herman Bearchecker returns. We always talk about some county things, some state things, some federal things. A little more focus on the federal at the moment here, especially with President Trump coming in, returning, shall we say, in 2025. Welcome back to the show, as always, Herman. What's going on?
Hey, I wanted to also comment on your previous caller. I did the same thing in the 80s, going to Costa Rica on a United flight.
Oh, yeah? And so you just asked, and you were able to go up and fly in the jump seat?
Well, I had my pilot's license, and I did the same thing. I asked the stewardess, and yeah, about 10 minutes later, she said, come on up. Yeah. And you got to remember, we didn't have locked cockpit doors until after 9/11.
It wasn't until that time, huh? Okay.
Yeah.
All right. So were they just latches or just a basic latch that was on them? No lock on them?
Yeah, just like a bathroom door.
Oh, okay. Well, no wonder.
Yep.
Yeah. I must say, though, there's something that has been lost since that time, because I remember even as a little kid, flying was a really special thing. It was a big deal. You got dressed up for it. You didn't put on your pajamas and go down, you know, to the airport in order to.
Well, on the old 707, 727s, they were kind of the mainstay jetliners back in the 60s. They even had ashtrays on every seat, if you can remember that.
Yes, I can.
Yeah.
By the way, a little sideline note on this, there is one aspect of when they banned smoking on the airlines. Do you recall when that first happened?
I think it was in the 70s, maybe.
Was it the 70s?
No,
all right.
No, it was later than that, because I owned a restaurant in the 80s, and we still allowed smoking then, so it was somewhere back then.
See, now you have to go at a casino, a tribal casino, to be free, you know, these days. You know, that kind of thing.
Or down in Reno, the casino's down there.
Yeah, so. It's pretty wild. But I remember reading about how mechanics actually had to come up with different aircraft inspection, what do they call it, techniques. That was what I was looking for, the procedures, because what they used to do is that they were able to check for cracks in the fuselage because they were able to see the trails of nicotine smoke that would leak through from the cabin, and you'd have the little stain on the outside of the fuselage skin. You know, oh, okay, so we got some problems here. That ended up that all the smoking that would go on in the planes in those days ended up helping the mechanics find problems with the skin on the airline. I thought it was interesting.
I'm sure there's some photos of inside airplanes in the 60s, and it probably looked like our house. You know, you had I always call it the smoke level, and it just depended on how many people were in the house were smoking, and the more people, the lower the level got.
Yeah, dynamite, all right. So why don't we take a look ahead here? We only got a couple weeks left, really. In fact, 2 weeks from today will be my final show of 2024, and then I won't be back until after the new year's. We'll all be getting back together, have a new president coming in here pretty quickly, and I get the impression that President Trump is probably going to have to deal with a recession. What do you think about that?
Well, yeah, a recession's in our future. There's no question about it. I mean, the retraction of dollars that are floating around in the economy, and the fact that the wages haven't kept up with inflation.
And by the way, I'm not advocating this. I'm not wanting to be a doomsayer. I'm just saying, though, that...
No.
We're just talking about how there's been this glut of money that was force-fed through the system, through the Biden administration, and through the end, frankly, the end of the last Trump administration there, too, is where that really started, trying to keep the plates going. And as you have so deftly noted here, when it comes to county finances, that money has been going away. It's been dribbling away. And the last of it's really starting to dribble. I know they're trying to get a lot of it stuffed into the channel at the end of the year in the Biden administration. You know, they're trying to spend money. I don't think they're going to be incredibly successful at it. What say you?
No, they're not. But even, you know, little Josephine County, you know, we just appropriated the last of the ARPA dollars. They had to be appropriated by the end of the year. And so we got that done. I mean, Everybody's every government agency has been spending money like a drunken sailor. Well, you know, I shouldn't say that because drunken sailors, they spend their own money. So I don't want to use that. But have been spending money like crazy, you know, and it's just, we got to get it out. We got to get it moving and stuff. Well, that's all coming to an end. And like I said, wages have not kept up. And I, you know, I'm so baffled when people say, oh, you know, inflation's not that bad anymore. It hasn't went down. Okay. Yes. The rate has went down, but inflation, we're still over 20%.
I was at Food for Less the other day, and a dozen eggs, medium eggs, not even the big eggs. Maybe they were large. I don't know. $4.58. Don't talk to me about inflation in the real world there for most folks.
Yeah, go,
okay.
Go buy a brand new full-size pickup and tell me we don't have inflation. Okay, you know, it's $100,000 for a full-size pickup anymore.
I mean, people might be getting used to where their prices are, but they haven't slid back. I think about the only thing which has actually retreated has been gasoline prices. Gasoline prices have retreated. I'm seeing it under $3 a gallon in some places now. Been a long time since we've seen that.
Well, and that's what Trump's going to do is he is going to reduce the energy, but there's always this lag time. So a recession is inevitable. The question is how bad, how deep and how bad. I actually think it's going to be a lot milder, but it's coming. And, the Trump administration, they're smart. They want to have it in their first year. Get it over with.
Yeah, get it over with. Have it in the first year if it is going to happen. And a lot of time, you know, if you're given a choice, if you want to let it happen in some cases and have the malinvestment get washed out, would that be a good way of looking at it? The malinvestment in the system. And we're also looking at the EV, the bloom's off that rose, right? The electric vehicles, yeah. The whole EV agenda, really.
Well, there's a certain amount of people that are just, they just drink that Kool-Aid and believe that that's what we have to do. So there'll still be some of that going on. But he's gonna work hard at getting energy down because that will be the factor that starts boosting the economy, okay? It's just because everything takes energy to move.
What I'm wondering about here, Herman, is what can the Trump administration do to reduce or stem the rise of electrical prices? Because, you know, that's a big challenge out here. I have a bill from the radio station transmitter, the old KMED AM I found, from 1998. And so we're talking 25, 26 years ago, not that long ago in the grand scheme of things. And electricity was one-fourth the price that it is right now. It's gone up four times since 1998. Pacific Power. It's insane.
Well, yeah. So, you know, we're just talking about our little bubble. One of the biggest drivers of our electricity going up is Brookshire Hathaway Energy has convinced the Public Utility Commission to have huge rate increases so that they can harden for wildland fire. So that the last two increases were because of that. And the Public Utility Commission granted that. Mm-hmm. So those, you know, that's for, you know, new power poles, new, all that stuff. Just it's hardening for wildland fire. So that's not coming off of the back of Brookshire Hathaway Energy. That's coming off the back of the average landowner. So that's the last two big ones. And they were big. They were big rate increases.
Yeah. And they want another one for next year, too. I know that.
Yeah. And you know what gets me is, so then, okay, now we get everything hardened for wildland fires. Shouldn't the rates go back down?
No,
they're never
going to
go down.
No. Yeah, the cost of electricity will rise to the permitted level because the one thing people don't understand, I think, a lot of times about public utilities is that they have a guaranteed rate of return on whatever money they spend. So even if the rates go up, they still get their guaranteed rate, right?
That's correct.
That's the way this ends up working here. Now, my question is, though, do you believe that President Trump will be able to use the tariffs as he has talked frequently about, because I'm going to give you my opinion. It sounds really good.
Tariffs can be a double-edged sword, okay?
Okay.
So, yeah, they got to – they can't just make a blanket statement and say we're going to have tariffs. Okay, what are we going to have tariffs on, and who are we going to have tariffs with? That's the question that has to be answered. So, don't talk in generalities about tariffs because, like I said, they're a double-edged sword.
About the only thing that he should be tariffing in a proper world, in my opinion, is stuff that we make here, to protect stuff that we actually make here, truly make here. Would you agree on that?
Well, yeah, I do. But, you know, we're kind of our own worst enemy. I mean, we make doing business so expensive because of regulation, minimum wages, all that stuff. And remember a few weeks ago, I was talking about our farmers. You know, that have to compete with countries where they're paying, you know, $5 or $10 a day for their labor. How do you compete with that? And also the regulation. When you start traveling around the world and you get out of the Western countries, the regulations are almost non-existent, you know?
And so if somebody wants to build something, they just build something. Right?
They just build it, yeah.
You want to put up a factory, you put up a factory, and here it's completely different. I was talking about that early this morning, you know, because Bill London, our news guy, was reporting how Oregon's, what was it called, the median income, just a little bit over $50,000 a year, and that is number 48 out of 50 states. 48 out of 50 states here, Herman. And,
well, Josephine County is down around 30,000. It's 29.8, I think it was.
Yeah. And we have to connect it then to essentially the environmental control of the state because this has been a natural resource-based economy for such a long, long time. And you replace natural resources, which we still have, by the way. We're just burning them, you know, in the summertime. You replace them with service jobs. You know, you flip a... You know, you go from working at Rough and Ready to working at Big Lots, which, of course, is going out of business now. It's not the same thing. It's not the equivalent. A job is not a job necessarily. Jobs are not equivalent in money.
Well, we don't have big business. We just don't have big business in Oregon, you know, and you just don't have it.
And our policies make sure that we don't. Wouldn't that be fair?
I think it was last week we talked about, you know, we're the highest in income tax. So that's. You know, what you got to remember is that's just not targeted at the company. So say I'm a big company mm-hmm. and I want to come to Oregon. I go, the taxes, the income, corporate taxes, high. Anyway. It's also the income taxes for all of your employees. So you say, well, how do I attract these highly skilled employees into this environment of high taxation? So that's why, you know, if you retire, if you're a single person making $125,000 or a married couple making $250,000 and you retire and you move to even the state of Washington, you immediately save 10% on your income.
So do you think that the very progressive income tax is at root here? Because other states have sales tax, but Oregon has made it very clear they are not fans of sales taxes. They just don't like it.
No, they don't. And that's why... You're seeing big manufacturing jobs. That's what's driving them out of this country is regulations and wages. It's as simple as that. And Mexico is going to be the winner in the next, 30, 40 years. Mexico, one, they have the labor force. Two, the labor force is young. And three, they don't have the regulations. Mm-hmm. So that's why John Deere and Ford and all the big players are building their factories in Mexico.
So if they're really looking to make America great again, Trump administration is going to have to take a big weed whacker to what's going on in the regulatory state. Think he can do it?
Well, they're talking, we'll see. I mean, when Trump said that he's going to cut 200 agencies out of the federal government, I'm like, wow, that's big. And, you know, but if we don't, Bill, if we do, we have third world countries are coming online now, and if we're going to compete with them, they're coming online. They're emerging, and if we don't compete with them, we're going to be out. You know, it's just that simple. Germany is experiencing the same exact thing. And, of course, Japan is too. But, you know, Japan's policies are really bad. They have never pulled their economy out since the early 1990s. You realize?
It's been several lost decades that they've had. We know about that. I had a listener that popped me a message and wanted to know if you think that given that the Trump administration is going to be opening up federal land for oil exploration, do you see a change when it comes to perhaps opening up public lands in Josephine County and Jackson County for other purposes, whether it actually being perhaps a little friendlier to logging or getting some value out of these lands other than burning them at taxpayer expense, which is what we do right now? What do you think? What does your gut tell you about 2025 and beyond?
Congress has to overhaul the Endangered Species Act and the rules that surround it. So that's the regulation part. Because it's just too easy for the environmental community to file lawsuits, and then no matter how many efforts you put forward to do that, they just keep filing the lawsuits because they have the tool of the Endangered Species Act.
So it's just that simple.
I mean, look what FEMA just did. You know, come out with this. Oh, if you're going to build in the flood area.
And then they expand what a flood area is, right?
Yeah, they expand what it is, and then they say if you're going to build there, you got to get environmental assessment and a survey for endangered species because of a court ruling over the orca whale. So, you know, that has to stop. If it does not stop, we're not going to go forward, and we're going to. You know, there are some people in this world that would love to see the United States go down in scale and let the emerging countries come up so they're more even. I'm not in favor for that. I'm in favor for putting our best foot forward.
You know, the one thing I wanted to circle on, I agree with you, but back to the tariff thing, you'll have to be pretty careful. He's talked about it a lot in Rick Newman over at Yahoo Finance. I was reading an article of his the other day in which he was talking about what happens in the real world with certain things. You know, you put a tariff on something because you're hoping to develop a domestic industry, right? You know, that kind of thing. And Rick Newman on Yahoo had written about, what was it? It was washing machines. Because the Trump administration, first one, ended up putting a big tariff on washing machines. And so washing machines got a lot more expensive, and the tariff went off a year or two ago. I think it was during the Biden administration. And the price of a typical washer and dryer went down $80 to $100 each, you know, because of that tariff going away. And the economists figured out, according to Rick's story, that every job saved at, let's say, the Whirlpool plant in the United States of America, there were like 2,000 people that have been making washers and dryers in the United States, but for every job saved, it costs American consumers $800,000. See what I'm getting at? So,
yeah. Well, you know, the economy, going clear back to Adam Smith's book, The Wealth of Nations, it's really not as complicated as it may seem. I mean, Adam Smith wrote that book, and it's really whoever makes the best widget at the best price gets the sale.
Right.
Okay? That's the basic. That doesn't change. I mean, that has not changed. Whoever makes the best product at the best price gets the best, gets the sale.
I think what's going to complicate President Trump's economic plan, though, is that when you are the world reserve currency, which we are, and he's been making a lot of noise. He doesn't want people to go away from this. When you are the world reserve currency, by definition, you're exporting your inflation. And that's going to, by definition, also make you more of an importer than you might otherwise think. So you kind of got a balancing job to do here, don't you?
Oh, absolutely. And, you know, Brexit, those aren't any slouches of economies. I mean, you got some pretty hefty hitters there, you know. You got Brazil and China and South Africa is actually one of the little ones, but, you know, I would take that very serious. Brazil is a hell of an economy. It's a big country with lots of natural resources, and the wages are a lot lower, and the regulations are a lot lower, and You know, they can build things. They're building airplanes and all kinds of stuff now. And so that's the bottom line. It's gotten too expensive to do business, well, here in Oregon, but also the United States on it when you look at it on a world order.
So you have to find a way to make American labor costs more competitive. That's just the way it is, unfortunately. You just got
to
do it.
It is. Mm. You have to compete. Go right back to what I said, Bill. Adam Smith wrote it, what, how many years ago? 400 years ago, whatever he wrote that book. Whenever he wrote The Wealth of Nations, is whoever has the best product for the best price gets the sale.
There we go.
And that's how we became a – that's how we rose to the top so fast.
Now, we were to be fair, though, we were tariffing seriously at that point because the federal government was much smaller, but that's how the federal government was funded there. Probably be a lot more difficult to fund the current federal government that way. What would you say?
Yeah, because we didn't have all these free handouts.
Yeah, and that, I think, was the main reason why we grew so fast. We were a young, vigorous country, and a lot of ambitious people came here back in those days. The wild salmon of society ended up showing up rather than the salmon sitting in the back of the cart being towed by the people up front. So anyway.
Well, all you have to do is look at the federal budget, and Congress really only has authority to move a very small portion of the money around. Most everything is mandated, earmarked money, you know, with Social Security and Medicaid and all of the pensions and military pensions and everything.
It's all friction in the gears, isn't it? All of it.
And well, take a look at it. It's incredible. It gobbles up. When you throw the interest on the debt on there, Congress just has this little sliver of the pie to move things around. It's actually astonishing. And anybody can go to the National Debt Clock and look at that and study it. There's a lot. It's a very busy website. There's a lot of stuff going on. So don't think you're going to digest it in 5 minutes. But you sit there for a while and you start understanding what all those numbers are. And you're like, why have Congress? They hardly have the authority to do much as far as appropriations.
Yeah, so much of it is on autopilot, all right? Hey,
yeah.
Point well taken, but prepare for the belt cinching in 2025 for all of our government agencies here. I think that's just going to be baked in the cake here, all right? Herman, always appreciate it. See you next time. You be well this week,
right?
Okay? Thanks again.
Have a good week, Bill. Thank you.
You too. Josephine County Commissioner Herman Bertschiger digs a lot into the economy, too, and, of course, former ORP chair.